Frank Buckley. This time on the program, it's a conversation about something that's become so central to our lives, and if you believe my guest today, so destructive in many ways to our lives and to our society. I'm talking about technology, and specifically social media and Google and the data that's being collected on each one of us who uses technology. My guest today knows better than most how technology is being used to manipulate us because he was one of the guys who used to do it at Google until he got out. My guest is Tristan Harris. Atlantic Magazine has described him as the closest thing Silicon Valley has to a conscience. Tristan appears in the documentary drama The Social Dilemma on Netflix.
When you go to Google and type in climate change is, you're going to see different results depending on where you live and the particular things that Google knows about your interests.
A Netflix original documentary is one of the most frightening and important films you will see this year. The Social Dilemma features some of the very people who created Google and the social media sites that know everything about us.
It's not enough that you use the product consciously. I want to dig down deeper into the brainstem and implant inside of you an unconscious habit so that you are being programmed at a deeper level. You don't even realize it.
And welcome to Frank Buckley Interviews. Joining me now is the man you just heard from in The Social Dilemma. That was Tristan Harris. He is a former Google design ethicist, and he is a co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. Tristan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Of course. What we heard you just say is so disturbing. This idea that when you were at Google, you were using what you know about persuasion and technology to go deep into our brains to program us, or to put it another way, maybe manipulate us. And I kept thinking, to what? To what end?
Well, you know, as is detailed in the film, the real issue here is that when you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And specifically, when I say you're the product, it's that our behavior, the predictability of how we act and believe, is the very thing that's being sold. So I make more money the more of your attention that I get, right? How much have you paid for your Facebook or YouTube account recently? You know, nothing. How are they worth $700 billion or $1 trillion in market cap? Well, it's because they're monetizing our attention. And so to do that, these companies have to build supercomputers so that when you flick your finger, this huge supercomputer has to predict what's the perfect thing I could dangle in front of your nervous system that's going to keep you here. And if I don't do it, the other guy will. So if Netflix starts calculating the perfect next video for you and I'm YouTube and I don't do that or I do it less well, I'm going to get outcompeted. And that's why it becomes this race to the bottom of the brainstem for who can go lower into our limbic brain, into our emotions, into our fear, into our personalization. Because one of the key things, as you mentioned in the introduction, is that these companies make more money the more they personalize a reality for us. So when you flick your finger, imagine Facebook had an option between giving you a news feed called the challenge feed and one called the confirmation you're right feed, right? Mm. So in the challenge feed, you flick your finger and every time it shows you something that disagrees with you or maybe part of a more shared reality. That's not going to do nearly as well at keeping your attention than if you this other confirmation news feed where every time you flick your finger, it gives you even more evidence of why you're right. And I think we've never seen more evidence of all of this taking place, this kind of shredding of reality into different micro realities from social media, than now after the election, where you have, you know, completely different views about what's happened. And I think there's a stat that something like more than 50% of Republicans currently believe that Trump won the election. And obviously on the left-hand side, people believe that all the claims of voter fraud are illegitimate. And so, you know, we really are seeing different movies right now. And I think people underestimate the extent to which this came from social media.
Well, and that's exactly what jumped out at me as I was watching The Social Dilemma. I couldn't help but wonder how much this idea of delivering news and information to someone that comports to their point of view means that people who are on opposite sides of any particular issue or political point of view, we are never going to hear each other because we're operating from a different set of facts when we go on a search engine. Am I wrong?
No, that's 100% right. And you know, I think also not just a different set of facts, but a different set of grievances. Because if you are, say, a Biden supporter, you've seen video after video after video in your newsfeed of Trump supporters being nasty to Biden supporters. Mm-hmm. But if you're on the Trump side, you've seen video after video after video of cars driving by honking white supremacist, white supremacist, white supremacist at you. And so we actually have a very different set of ideas about how nasty the other side is, because social media selects for the worst of us and broadcasts that to the rest of us. And so, you know, if you take the election right now, you know, people on the right-hand side who believe Trump won see evidence after evidence after evidence of reported assertions and stories of potential voter fraud in every state. And it's just, you know, one story after the other. So it feels very true because you have lots and lots of stories. Right. But of course, all it takes for that to show up is people asserting that it's real. I was actually invited to speak at a Detroit news station because there was a false story that actually was a picture of someone loading something into these big black cases. And the news story was that they were fake ballots being loaded into, ballots that were, you know, being loaded in these cases. Right. It actually turned out it was a photo of their own photographer who was just loading their camera right. into one of these black faces, but it was being mislabeled as this was some kind of voter fraud. And of course, as we say in the film, fake news spreads 6 times faster than true news. So even after that was reaching so many people, do you think that once the correction came in, that correction made it to the minds of the people who saw it and believed it? No. Moreover, even if the correction does come to the minds of the people who saw it, our minds tend to remember what we want to believe to be true. That's what the research shows. Even after you're given a correction, people remember the thing that they want to believe. Mm. And I think this is what's so damaging, is we realize that it's not because you're wrong if you're on the left or you're on the right. It's that all of us have been through this massive mind-warping process where 3 billion human social animals have been jacked into this system of constant psychological influence, and we're now 10 years in to this warping process.
And it's one thing for all of us as adults to experience this, but you guys in the film say they're coming after our kids as well. I want to show a clip from The Social Dilemma about that.
We're training and conditioning a whole new generation of people that when we are uncomfortable or lonely or uncertain or afraid, we have a digital pacifier for ourselves that is kind of atrophying our own ability to deal with that.
So what you're saying is we have the inability, and that starts at a young age, to essentially have an imagination or to talk with other human beings or to do the things that we've always done as human beings.
Yeah, I mean, I think this presents profound questions about what does it mean to be human and what does it mean to be growing up in a healthy way as a child. And I think that what we have to realize is as these companies are competing for attention, they're competing to offer these more and more frequent, seductive, you know, dopamine hijacking rewards, right? So you post a photo and TikTok is competing to give you even more likes and comments and positive feedback than you would get if you were on Instagram. So they're literally competing for who can give you a better return on your slot machine. Mm. And in that competition, it's much like in food where, you know, the big agriculture, you know, the big industrial food companies are competing for more and more combinations of salt, sugar, and fat, not actually what makes kids healthy. Because just like in food, there's a finite amount of stomach share. And how do you get, you know, enough of the stomach share? In the attention economy, there's a finite amount of human attention. And I'll tell you a personal story. I once sat in a cafe with a friend who worked at Facebook. He was a product manager. This is several years ago. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, people think that our biggest competitor are other social networking sites because they think that's the category we're in. So maybe Twitter's our biggest competitor. But what he said was our biggest competitor at Facebook is YouTube, because YouTube is competing for the bigger share of attention that we have to get from our from those kids. Mm. And so again, just like Joe Camel and cigarettes, where you have to go after kids younger and younger, and you had the cigarette companies inventing cartoon characters to try to reach kids, we now have tech companies that are trying to figure out, how can I get you younger and younger with Snapchat or younger and younger with Instagram? And as we say in the film, for 10 to 14-year-old girls, there's been a marked increase in both self-harm, suicide, and depression, and many think because of social media, as Jonathan Haidt says in the film.
And I was going to ask, you know, to those people who would say, look, it's just content. I'm enjoying the content. These platforms amuse me. What's the big deal? That seems like one big deal.
Yeah, well, so I think we have to make a distinction between what we want versus what we'll watch. And it's easy when people keep clicking on something to say, well, they wouldn't be clicking on it unless they wanted it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we would assume. If you keep clicking on those photos or videos, that must mean that's what you want. And it's our job as a business to give you what you want. But when our attention doesn't work that way, because imagine you're driving down Highway 5 and everyone's attention looks over at the car crash. Well, according to Google and Facebook, the whole world just must love car crashes. We should just feed you car crashes all day long.
Yeah.
And there's different versions of those car crashes that are essentially, you know, essentially social comparison, instant slot machine rewards, conspiracy theories. Mm. These are all things that are really good at getting attention but are not good for us.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a short break. We've started to lay out some of the issues that we've heard about in the social dilemma. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and ask Tristan what we can do about it.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
My phone is a slot machine. Every time I check my phone, I'm playing the slot machine to see what am I going to get? What am I going to get? Every time I check my email, I'm playing the slot machine to say, what am I going to get? Every time I scroll a news feed, I'm playing the slot machine to see what am I going to get next, right?
That's Tristan Harris at TEDx Brussels. And Tristan, you go on to say in that TED Talk that you know this stuff and you're still sucked in. And so what chance do we have of reclaiming our time and fighting these urges to pick up our phones?
Yeah, you know, it's such a great question. And you know, for those who don't know the background here, I studied at a lab and a part of a class at Stanford called Stanford Behavior or Persuasive Design class, where many of the alumni at these companies actually studied there. And it's all about how do you influence these deep mechanisms in the human mind. You know, I was also a magician growing up, and I think that's how we should see technology, is it's tapping into these early lower level instincts. And one of the fascinating things about that discipline is that no matter how much you know about slot machine rewards, it doesn't change the fact that it still feels really good. Mm-hmm. No matter how much you know about something called social reciprocity, when someone likes your photo that's a friend, you feel like you have to like theirs back, mm-hmm. right? That's social reciprocity. Just because I know about that effect doesn't mean I escape it. One last one is, you know, Frank, if you got 100 comments on your photo and 99 are positive and one is negative, where does your attention go? Mm. Right? It always goes to the negative one.
Yeah.
And obviously, all of us do this, but kids are particularly vulnerable to that. And think also that even when you don't look at that anymore and you close your phone down, your mind is still thinking about that negative comment that you got.
Right.
And so I think once you realize this, we have to basically acknowledge what we don't really have as much control over. And how do we set up these gateways? You know, as Justin Rosenstein says, I wouldn't put cookies in my pocket. How do we turn off all the notifications on our phone? Mm. How do you download something like Newsfeed Eradicator, which actually takes away the newsfeed from all your major social network sites? Mm. How do you delete the mobile apps off of your phone for social media? How do you just use it on desktop? How do you keep yourself logged out by default so you have to type your password manually to give you kind of PPE gear for your brain mm-hmm. that forces you to take this conscious step instead of an unconscious use? Yeah. I think these are the kinds of things we have to think about. We have a bunch of tips on our website, humanetech.com. There's a page called Take Control where there's actually many different things that people can do. Obviously, though, what we're really talking about is a systemic problem, much like climate change. You know, with climate change, we all need to do what we can do in our own lives, but we also need to pass regulations and laws to help reduce emissions.
Well, I wanted to.
And similarly, here, we have a whole industry that's based on manipulating our attention, manipulating our kids, and tearing apart our democracy, and we actually have to have regulation that changes those core incentives.
I wanted to ask you about that, and I wanted to begin the question by talking about something that we saw in the film. I thought of it as your sort of Jerry Maguire moment when you were at Google and you sat down and essentially wrote a mission statement of conscience, of saying, look, we know these things that we are doing to the people who use our product. We've got to be better human beings. It had a great reception within the company. People wanted to do something about it. But I don't think that much has changed. And it suggested to me that these companies are not going to change because there is a disincentive to change. Okay. They make money the more they have, as you say, our attention. So is it regulation? Is it classifying some of these platforms as publishers so that they can be sued when horrible things are said about other human beings? What are some of the answers?
Yeah, well, like you said, you know, there's only so much you can do when your stock price depends on continuing the problem. And so, you know, I don't see evil people at tech companies. I don't see people who are twirling their mustache happily, right, making the world worse. I see this as an accident, and they're kind of like hostages in a hostage video where you listen to what they say, and it doesn't really make sense until you see the person holding a gun off stage at their head, which is their business model.
Right.
So what we really need to do is help them out by regulating and changing their business model. As you said, they should be treated more like publishers and curators, mm-hmm, instead of as just neutral platforms, because they're not neutral platforms. I think we have to think about, just like we protect, you know, we don't just say everything in our parks are worthy for drilling, mm-hmm, and we just slaughter all the animals. We say there's such a thing as national parks. We don't drill there. I think how do we treat children's attention as if that's a national park? So you can imagine, for example, what if we don't allow monetizing any child's use of social media? Mm-hmm. You could say at all, or you could say at least between 10 p.m. and 7 in the morning. That's a national park, because essentially if you're monetizing attention there, you're incentivizing sleeplessness, depression, and isolation, because we know late night use of these things only makes us feel worse. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a whole bunch of things that need to happen, but what we really need to do is look at the business model. Because so long as we say in the film, you know, just like a whale is worth more dead than alive, and a tree is worth more as 2x4s than as a tree, in this model, we are the whale. We are the tree that's worth more when we're predictable, when we're distracted, when we're addicted, outraged, attention-seeking, polarized, and disinformed, than if we're thriving citizens of a democracy who have lives outside the screen.
Yeah.
Or if we're children who are playing on a park outside. So this is really about how do we reclaim our human dignity and autonomy.
When we hear what these companies are doing to us and to our children, we think, don't these people have a conscience? And it sounds to me like you're saying, yes, they do. That the people who actually work within these companies do have consciences, do want to do the right thing, but in this framework of the business model, they're not able to affect change in a positive way.
Yeah, I think both things are true, because, you know, one thing we say in the film is that one way you know there's a problem is if people don't give a product to their own children. Mm. And the CEO of Lunchables Foods didn't give Lunchables to his own kids. Mm. And that should tell you everything. And many people who actually are executives at these social media companies don't give social media to their own children. And so I think that should really tell you a lot. Now, again, as you said, I think there's good-hearted people who are trying to do the best they can. They've been slow coming around. I don't want to give them too much credit. We've had to actually create some real public pressure. Mm-hmm. But I think post the film coming out, and The Social Dilemma has been seen by 40 million people, at least, probably closer to 50 million now, I think that gives us an opportunity to say the public understands there's a problem and we need to change it.
Yeah, because my concern and fear is that, as in your Jerry Maguire moment at Google, it's well received. People think it's a wonderful thing that you're saying, and then there is no change that occurs. We're going to take one final break. When we come back, what can you do right now to protect yourself and your family? We're going to ask Tristan Harris when we come back.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?"
Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're back with Tristan Harris, former Google design ethicist and co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. Tristan, people who see the social dilemma may wonder, what can I do right now to protect myself, to protect my family from the manipulation that we see in this film? So what can we do right now?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people who see the social dilemma, they want to unplug from social media and delete the social media apps. And I think as many people who can do that should. I think what you have to recognize is that even if you're not on social media, you are still affected by living in a country in which everyone else will vote based on what they see on social media. Mm. And I think we have to really recognize that. Now, what can we do? One of the things, especially going into Thanksgiving, as we, you know, sit around the dinner table with people who have been living in a different micro reality than ours, is to actually, you know, I think frankly, watch The Social Dilemma. We've seen a lot of families get benefit from actually sharing that movie together and then being able to have common ground about the breakdown of common ground. What we've seen is people, what they do after the film is they do a reality swap. You open up Facebook on both phones, and you actually swap phones with someone, or like Freaky Friday, step into their meat suit and their body, right? And actually scroll through their feed for a while, and you start to get a sense. Imagine if I was living in this world for the last 10 years, how might I see reality differently? And I think we need new empathy for why we're disagreeing so much. And we always have a choice, Frank. You know, we can all either in a moment of conflict escalate and get more angry, or realize that we've been shown systematically the last 10 years things that are driving us to be more angry, and we can choose healing and de-escalation. Yeah. And I just hope that over Thanksgiving, people can do that. And if they're looking for more, please check out more on our website, you know, at humanetech.com.
I just wonder, since the film has come out on Netflix and more people have been watching it, do you feel more optimistic than you did, say, a few months ago?
You know, actually, as much as it might seem, I really want people to know, because it might feel depressing after you see the film, I've never seen more positive progress from around the world, more comments from people inside the company sending me messages saying, you wouldn't believe how this is being received and what we're actually reconsidering about some of the things that we're doing. You know, governments that are speaking out, schools showing it to their entire school and saying, how do we get parents to make a collective commitment to move off of one of these platforms to something that's not as toxic?
Yeah.
I think there's so much there.
When you were at Google, at what point did you realize this was an issue? When did it start to bother you, I guess, is the question that I'm asking.
You know, I actually was in the Santa Cruz Mountains with my co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, Asa Raskin, whose father, by the way, invented the Macintosh project at Apple. His name was Jeff Raskin. And we had been really concerned about these issues for some time. We had conversations about it. And we just got back from this weekend in the woods where you're really reconnecting with nature and you're really reconnecting with some of the kind of basics of what it means to be human. And it was after that trip that I came back and decided I was just going to make this presentation. You know, and the words came to me like out of nowhere. I said, you know, never before in history have 50 designers at 3 or 4 tech companies shaped what 2 billion people are going to be thinking, feeling, and doing on a daily basis because of the choices that they make about how these screens work. And I remember just that opening and working on that with Asa. And it was I knew that it was going to be important. I actually didn't expect that it would all be well received and I might get fired, you know, for the presentation, even though there was nothing specifically that was, you know, adversarial about what I was trying to say. It was just a call to arms and a, you know, a broadcasting of concern. And I sent it to about 10 people who were friends at Google for feedback and said, you know, hey, what do you think of this? And it wasn't ready yet for mass distribution to everybody. And the next day I came to work and there was something like, you know, 100 emails in my inbox, and I clicked on the link and, you know, there was 450 simultaneous viewers, and I knew that people were spreading it. So I quickly finished the last part of the presentation to sort of fill in the end. And it really felt like there was a moment where people actually cared You know, and that was an exciting thing to realize, that you're tapping into something human, that people do care, you know, about the impact that we're having, but you have to kind of talk about it. And obviously, as we say in the film, you know, I tried to change things more further inside of Google for several years. And I ultimately had to leave, because it's not that there's these greedy people in tech companies who just want to maximize how much money they make and they could care less about society. It's that, just like the, you know, what is it Hannah Arendt calls the banality of evil, there's just kind of the going with the flow and going with the incentives, and you get paid more the more you increase engagement. And every product manager, those 20-year-olds who are sitting inside of Facebook or Snapchat or Twitter, they get a bonus if they can get increased engagement on the site by 15 or 20%. And so it just kind of keeps going. And I realized that we needed to create some kind of external pressure for this to change.
And culturally within that milieu, I mean, these young people are thinking, okay, I want to make more money. I'm also a person of conscience. Is there someone within that culture who can say, hey, that's not right. Let's think about society. Is it really at the sort of CEO chairman level? And is that person thinking about these issues?
Yeah, well, you know, as we said in the film, the presentation went to Larry Page, the then CEO of Google, several times. We had a conversation about it once. And I think I've tried everything, it feels like, over the last 8 years. We, you know, we've tried working with the people at the bottom who are the foot soldiers, you know, with boots on the ground, dealing with some of the issues about how the product design features work, because those are the people that will make the design change, right? Or they'll make the change in metrics about how success is measured. Are we going to measure time spent or addiction, or are we going to measure something else? Mm-hmm. And then I've talked to people at the more mid-level executive and senior vice president level, and then I've talked to CEOs. You know, I've found consistently one thing, that it's only when there's public pressure from the outside that really starts to move things along. Now, I don't want to discount the many good people working on the inside of these companies every day who do the real work, right? And they have to do the experiments on what will reduce the amount of sort of misinformation or polarization in society. But I should also mention that about 2 years ago, Facebook tried to reduce some of these problems by introducing a new metric called meaningful social interactions, which basically said, we're going to measure not how many clicks or likes something got, but we're going to measure downstream how many of your friends will click and like it more, mm-hmm. if you post it. And so they changed what success was. But inadvertently, what that led to was increasing political extremism, because we found out from several people that you know, political parties who would previously post a PDF of their policy wouldn't get nearly as many clicks after they made this change, and the people who were actually saying really extreme one-sided rhetoric would get way more attention. And so every single time they make these little tweaks, they have unintended consequences.
Yeah.
And it's you know, it's shaping every society, every culture, and every election around the world.
We talked about regulation and how that could make a difference, but what regulation? Because some people will say, look, you can't kill these businesses. They're crucial parts of our lives now. Do you have specific thoughts on what kinds of regulations would be helpful?
Yeah, I just want to say, I think when we talk about regulation, people might think this is some kind of leftist agenda to say the government should regulate free speech. And I want to quiet those concerns by saying that's not what I see this being about. If you think about a business model that's for which the premise is unchecked virality, that everything you post could go virally famous to hundreds of millions of people. That's what the value proposition is to each of us. That's why we keep using it. Mm-hmm. But that's a fundamentally unsafe premise, because something going viral and not being able to distinguish between a good faith actor and a bad faith actor, or one in which fake news has a 6 times advantage to real true news because it spreads 6 times faster, mm-hmm. is not going to lead to a healthy society. So how do we fix this? Well, I think we need to learn from the financial regulations after the financial crash in 2008, which is that we had a more risk-blind financial system. So you as a bank could be over-leveraged and lending out more money than you actually had,
right,
to capacity to make sure it was safe. In the same way, Facebook is lending out an exponential amount of impact, that one thing you could post could reach millions and millions of people in an unsafe way, and we haven't said whether or not that's safe for that society. So if you take a country like Ethiopia, you know, Facebook manages 80 elections per year, by the way, not just here in the United States, mm-hmm. but 80 elections per year. And then obviously hundreds of countries, which in some like Ethiopia, there's actually the risk of civil war.
Yeah.
And so that's a high risk country. And if we know that fake news is outcompeting true news, instead of saying, let's let every piece of content get spread to millions of people, what if we minimize the spread and say you can only spread one piece of content to a few people? Mm. And that's exactly what Facebook did in India, where with WhatsApp, which is another product that they run and own, it used to be you could share information to 200 people with one click. And then because that was unsafe, they brought it down to 5 people. Mm. So I think what we need to do is per country have a sense of how much risk or fragility is being introduced, just like with the financial system where we say, you know, there's AAA rated financial assets and mm-hmm. then there's kind of low rated junk financial assets. Yeah. And I think we have junk virality and bad toxic virality, and we have healthy and safe virality. And I think we have to have some notion of what is a safe social media environment that doesn't downgrade that society.
There are people who look at a Mark Zuckerberg and they think this guy has no conscience, that it's really about growing the business, and that's all it is. Do you know Mark, and do you have a thought on that?
I try not to take sides on individual people, but I will say I think it's been clear for a long time now that there are many harms that are coming from this business model, and he is in an incredibly difficult position. As the writer Upton Sinclair said, you can't get someone to question something that their salary depends on them not seeing. Mm. And I feel like their business model makes it impossible for Zuckerberg to reckon with what is fundamentally the truth of the situation, which is that this is a cannibalistic economy where their business model is about kind of commodifying and eroding the life support systems, children's mental health, the attention of a democracy, the ability for a democracy to have a shared reality and a shared set of facts. That's directly against the business model. And until we can recognize that, Mark Zuckerberg, I do not think, is a safe person to run this company unless he changes course. And the question is, how much public pressure and attention will it take for him to change course? I think we're getting closer. But you know, honestly, the cost is to all of us. The cost is showing up on the balance sheets of each of our families, each of our communities, and even here in the United States, where we can't even agree on the outcome of the election, when it seems pretty clear that there is an outcome and we're not really respecting it.
Last question, Tristan. You are someone who clearly feels so passionately about this. You have known about these issues that we are facing for so long. You've been trying to get our attention for so long about it. Some of us are listening, many people are not. Is it hard for you day after day to know this, to know these things, and to try to get our attention, to try to get government to do something about it, and to not have those things happen?
You know, it is hard when you work for 8 years and you see sort of a train wreck that's, you know, just keep plowing, the train's keeping to plow down the train track in a way that's not safe for people. It is very psychologically difficult. It reminds me of those people who work on climate change and have to look at some pretty dark realities that if we don't change course, and we think of this as the climate change of culture, except, you know, much like climate change, the global South and the countries that don't have a lot of infrastructure get the worst of it. The more fragile democracies get the worst of it, because I care about everyone, you know, and not just, you know, white people in the United States or, you know, Western democracies. I will say, though, that I've never felt more optimistic, because I think this film, The Social Dilemma, has reached an unbelievable number of people, and I think shattered records for documentaries for Netflix. You know, it was released in 190 countries and in 30 languages. And I get emails and messages every day from people in Brazil who say, oh my God, this is why we got Bolsonaro and we're chopping down the rainforest. Mm. I get emails from people in, you know, Chile or in Indonesia, you know, or in India. And I think that everyone is resonating with it because it's giving voice and language to something that everyone's been feeling. And I think that that means that we have a global constituency to change this system now. And I will say, I'm hoping that with the future Biden administration, they will go after this problem, and that we can collectively agree that we have to find ways to agree, because if we don't, then we're just going to collapse into you know, more conflict with each other. And that actually is not a world where one side wins. It's a world where we all lose. And that's what I'm really hoping we take away from this, is that the film is a warning sign. It says we don't have to go down this path. We can do better.
Well, let's hope that many people hear that warning sign. Tristan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Frank.
My thanks again to Tristan Harris. If you'd like to see my conversation with Tristan, it airs this coming weekend on KTLA. New episodes of our program air every Saturday night after midnight at 12:35 a.m. and on Sunday at 4:30 in the afternoon. We also air the previous week's show at 5:30 a.m. on Saturday morning. And we put all of our TV shows on YouTube. Just search for Frank Buckley Interviews, Tristan Harris, to see this one. After our conversation about social media, it seems a little awkward to ask you to tag me on social media if you have any feedback on today's program. Still, I think the subject is worthy, and the more people who hear Tristan's message and hear about the social dilemma, the better, I think. Let me know what you think at Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram, and there's a Frank Buckley Facebook page as well. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.